Hello and welcome. What a fantastic turnout. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce to you all Abdul Rahman Malik, co-founder of the Radical Middle Way organisation, which has helped educating young Muslims post 7/7 and more. And it's sort of gone international. And Abdul does a lot of work now in building communities and sort of a spiritual basis for Islam in London and just further abroad as well. And they brought many scholars over here to have debate and discussion about Islam in this country and in many other countries. So as people are finally getting their seats, I just ask you to give a warm Greenbelt welcome to Abdul Rahman Malik.
First of all, thank you so much for coming. it's really gratifying to see all of you here, and I hope over the next hour we'll not only get to know one another, but share truth to truth and heart to heart. In the Muslim tradition, we always begin by saying Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Merciful, the Giver of Mercy. And for me as a Muslim, that opening invocation is so important because it sort of sets the framework for our debate and our discussion and our engagement with one another, that we gather here as people of belief and a people of faith, looking to God by His greatest attribute, that of mercy, and His greatest gift, that of the gift of mercy. And so I hope today, in the spirit of the merciful God who we all believe in, and the mercy that we pray and we hearken to, that the sharing that will happen will be meaningful, first of all, for myself, as I learn from you, and I hope for you as well. The second thing I want to say as a point of introduction is that I'm always really pleased and excited to be coming to Greenbelt. I often tell the organizers who are so gracious to have me back, that I think this is the best Muslim festival in the United Kingdom. And my wife and I have been trying over the past four or five years that we've been coming to encourage our friends and families to come, because in the 9 years I've lived here full time and in the 15 years I've been in the UK on and off, I have actually never found a space as welcoming and as godly as this one. And I always leave feeling very rich and very full. And I think that's a testament not only to the Greenbelt organization, but to each and every one of you who every year make us feel very welcome and part of the family. My final opening note before we dive right in is that I wish I could take full credit for the title of today's session, a title which I fully endorse and embrace, by the way. But I have to give credit where credit is due to my very dear friend Nigel Varndell, the activist par excellence, used to be at Christian Aid, now is at the Children's Society. Children's Society is running a great campaign on runaways, which I hope you get a chance to check out in G-Source. But Nigel, when we were talking about this over coffee, he's a Greenbelt veteran. He suggested, well, why don't you take this tack? And I said, Nigel, that's a brilliant idea as always. So 72 virgins and all that, I have to give credit to Nigel Varndell. Today I come to you as a seeker, not as a scholar. I think scholarship is a very high station, and particularly within the Islamic tradition, to be an alim, to be a scholar, to be someone who's engaged with sacred text and knowledge is actually a very, very high rank in a very high role, and involves, as you know from your traditions, an engagement with text and belief and practice, which I cannot hope to, at this point in my life, aspire to or take on for myself. But I come to you as a seeker and as a searcher, because I think one of the things about any religious tradition, and certainly about the Islamic religious tradition, is that we are born seeking. We are born seeking God. In Islam, we have a concept called fitra, and fitra means this innate, inbuilt, coded, hardwired to our souls need to know our Creator, need to know our story, where we came from, the magnificence from which we emerged. And so I today approach the question of paradise from a Muslim perspective as a seeker and as a searcher. And I come at it with sort of two problematics. I come at it with from two problematics, and I'll explain what those two problematics are. One is that I think any religious person, if they're honest with themselves, and I have to be honest with myself, that the moment we begin to approach the concept and the question of paradise, we are met with the unease of eternity. And for me, I remember being young, probably 10 or 12 years old, and sort of beginning to explore the Quran and being very excited by text and study circles and being at the mosque and sitting with our imam and enjoying the company of other young people who are also seeking and searching and learning and being very uneasy with eternity. I don't think that unease ever goes away. There's a place where the soul meets the intellect, and there's a kind of battleground between the two, which I don't believe ever entirely goes away. And so we're always dealing with, I'm certainly always dealing with these questions of understanding the ineffable and trying to understand the unseen. The second problematic is the problem of sensuality. Some would refer it as the problem of sex. The problem of seeing and understanding sensuality through the lens of faith and godliness. Because as we'll speak about in a moment, the Quranic and the Islamic descriptions of paradise are incredibly rich, at times incredibly sensual, at times even incredibly provocative. And for a young man who was told that no sex before marriage, no alcohol, no fooling around, and certainly no drugs. I made an exception for rock and roll. Being confronted by a vision of the hereafter that was profoundly sensual and evocative can actually cause a little bit of dissonance. And I would say this dissonance grows in the modern age more than it did in the past. It seems that those who came before us had a far healthier relationship with things sensual and evocative and provocative. That there was a normative space within societies and civilizations, particularly within Muslim civilization, where this kind of language and discourse was not only accepted, but was explored, expanded upon, and talked about. I think in our modern age of social conservatism, perhaps, and perhaps living as a minority faith within a majority faith, we kind of guard our space a little bit more tightly. And therefore, anything that seems outside the pale of that or challenges that makes us uneasy. So those are the two problematics with which I approach this. In the post 9/11 era, we've heard a lot about the paradise, the Muslim paradise that awaits the martyrs. We've certainly heard about this from people like Osama bin Laden and those who follow his aberrant and reprehensible interpretations of Islam. But I have to admit that the first time I ever came across this idea of the 72 virgins that await the martyr in paradise was not from any Muslim. I actually came across it in the early 90s when an American provocateur and right-wing goon, Stephen Emerson, produced a number of documentaries on Islam, and Islam in America in particular, looking at the rise of jihadism. Now, this is well before 9/11. This is certainly around the time of the first World Trade Center attacks in the early 90s. And there was this reference to a Muslim paradise that had 72 virgins. Well, being a young Muslim growing up in North America, being very active and engaged in his community, being very politically aware, because I grew up in a very politically aware and politically active family, this was all a bit of a shock. Where did these 72 virgins come from? The very fact that the word virgin was being used in relation to religion was difficult for me. So that involved, for me, a kind of first rejection. That can't possibly be right. Virgins? Islam? It doesn't work that way. But then, of course, that discourse grew louder and louder, where now, today, this has almost become secondhand. The amount of times I've heard from people who have respectable degrees and wear fancy suits and ties and work for institutes with four-letter acronyms, I've heard about 72 virgins in the Muslim paradise and the suicide bomber salivating in advance of committing his dastardly deed because he gets instant entry, you know, don't stop at, you know, get out of jail free card, don't stop along the way, get your 200 pounds when you cross the board and all that nonsense. That somehow this person gets a free ticket to paradise, and there is waiting for him basically a brothel, where he will live in forever, abiding for eternity. Well, I think this is problematic. And I also think that the vast majority of Muslims think it's problematic. And I also know that the vast majority of Islamic scholars and authorities think this is problematic, and I'll tell you why. Now, I'm going to begin with the 72 virgins, because in a way I want to get it out of the way, but I'm happy to talk about it later if you want to, in more detail. But I think... Tiny tea tent, anyone. But the reason why I want to get it out of the way, because I think underlying this is a far more interesting question about this search, my own search for what paradise means in my own tradition. And I think you, coming from your Christian traditions, will find a lot to share and maybe some difference as well. Now, to get right to the brass tacks, this number 72 appears actually in a statement of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And I'll read the hadith. Hadith are sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. As many of you will know, Islamic theology and Islamic sacred law derives from what are known as the first sources. And those sources are the Quran, which is the Muslim holy book, and the book we believe is the revelation of Allah, the final revelation following on the Old and New Testaments. And then also the sayings, deeds, and actions, and states of the Prophet Muhammad. So these two corpuses, these two, for us, great rich veins of knowledge, then are plumbed, and out of that is drawn theology, law, and spirituality. So the statement of the Prophet Muhammad that refers to these 72 is as follows. And the Prophet is speaking here about the martyr. And martyrdom is something that the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions share very deeply. The martyr has six unique traits, said the Prophet. He is forgiven immediately. He sees his seat in paradise, and he is saved from punishment of the grave. He is granted safety from the great terror of the day of reckoning. A crown of honor is placed upon his head, a ruby of which is better than this life and all it contains. And he is married to 72 maidens of paradise, and he is allowed to intercede for his relatives. Now, what's interesting to me about this list of sort of motivations and this list of rewards that wait for the martyr in paradise is that this reference to the 72 maidens is actually a passing one. It's not one that is highlighted. It's not one that is talked about to the exclusion of all the others. But it is one of the evocative phrases that is used to remind the would-be fighter for the sake of God that if they were to be martyred in a just cause, they would receive great benefit and great reward from God Almighty. Now, what does that say to me? Well, it says to me a number of things. It first of all says to me that there is a deep understanding in our religious traditions, and particularly in the Muslim religious traditions, of evoking motivation. Motivation is evoked, as we will see momentarily, in a number of different ways. But there is the physical, sensual motivation, the motivation of physical reward, whether that's richness, eternal life, whether that's youth, whether that's pleasure, whether that's food, whether that's gardens in paradise. These are very powerful, evocative words, and the Arabic language is a remarkably rich language, and it's a remarkably evocative language. And in fact, the wonderful thing about the Arabic language is that, you know, words have multiple meanings because they're drawn. They can be drawn and interpreted in a multitude of different ways. And so the English certainly doesn't do justice to the Arabic. So for the person who would have heard this, say, sitting at the feet of the Prophet himself, maybe on the eve of battle, And the vast majority of wars that were fought at the time of the Prophet were defensive ones. The Muslim community was a minority community on the Arabian Peninsula, threatened by stronger tribes and individuals who saw nothing but the death of the Prophet and the death of the community. That to hear these words would have been incredibly gratifying. That to place oneself in the way of God in this way would have meant receiving something in return. Now, what are these 72 maidens to in paradise? And this brings us to a very different question. And this brings us to a question of what the Muslim paradise looks like. And does this Muslim paradise apply equally to men and women? A very good and obvious question. And what is the ultimate goal that a Muslim sees when reaching paradise? As I said, the Islamic tradition is incredibly rich, in its descriptions. And I'm going to read some of the descriptions from both the hadith, from the statements of the Prophet Muhammad, and also from the Quran. And I want to I want you just to follow through the statements with me, because I think you'll begin to see connections between these various verses. Now, there is no one place in the Quran which says, here it is, folks, we're going to talk about paradise now. The Quran is actually a remarkably non-linear book, which is actually often very difficult if you are used to the Old and New Testament, which are far more linear. They are, tell a story and often tell it in a very direct ABCD way, although that's a simplification. But I think you will find the Bible far more linear than the Quran is. The Quran is actually, in many ways, a non-linear book. In fact, Muslim scholars themselves have explored the idea of coherence in the Quran. We know that, for example, the way the Quran is set up now in its 114 chapters and the placement of the verses, they are not in chronological order. They're in more of a thematic order. And that thematic order, the Muslim belief is, that was assembled when the revelation had completed. So in fact, the first revelation appears within the text of the Quran near the end of the Quran. Now, this is important. This is important because if evocations of paradise and references to the paradise that awaits the believing man and the believing woman are therefore scattered throughout the book. And it's interesting where you find them. And it's interesting where they appear, because they often appear in places that you wouldn't expect them to appear. For example, there'll be a discussion about a family law or divorce or about the nations that came before you, and all of a sudden there'll be an evocation of paradise. So often the God's evoking paradise or describing paradise or explaining paradise comes at moments when the reader or the reciter or the listener is least expecting it. There's a reason behind that. There's a reason behind that, and I'll explain that reason in a moment after I read the verses. So I want to begin first with a statement of the Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad said, and there's some statements of the Prophet Muhammad where the Prophet Muhammad speaks, and he speaks sort of in the voice of God. He says that God said. And God said, I have prepared for my righteous servants what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and what has not even occurred to the human heart. From a principal point of view, therefore, we must take every evocation of paradise in the Quran and in the Muslim tradition as what in Arabic we would call ishara, as indications, as a glimpse beyond the veil of the unseen, that in that glimpse we will see something, maybe of the smell, of the taste and the touch, although we can't smell it, we can't taste it, we can't touch it, but we have something of it. And so there's a powerful relationship between text and imagination. The text is calling us and calling the human heart to imagine what God's gift to his righteous servants, both women and men, is going to be. The Quran says, and no soul knows what joy has been kept hidden for the reward that they have done. They shall have whatever they wish, the Quran says in another verse, with their Lord. In another verse, the Quran tells us, and for the conscientious, there will be gardens with streams, and they will sit in the seat of truth in the presence of an omnipotent sovereign. The Quran continues, the righteous will be amid gardens and fountains of clear flowing water. Their greeting to each other will be, enter you here in peace and in security. and we shall remove from their hearts any lurking sense of injury. They will be brothers and sisters to one another, joyfully facing each other on thrones of dignity, and no sense of fatigue shall touch them, nor shall they ever be asked to leave. In another verse, gardens of perpetual bliss, the Quran says, stating emphatically the reward for the believers. They shall enter there as well as the righteous amongst their fathers and their spouses and their offspring. And angels shall enter unto them from every gate with the salutation, peace be unto you, for you persevered your lives in patience. Now find yourselves here in an excellent home. There's a lot of talk in the Quran about gardens and about water and about flowing rivers. In the Muslim traditions, we often see in the poetry, particularly of the Sufis, that this is evoked often and constantly. Part of it is context. The Quran was revealed in the Arabian Peninsula. Parts of the Arabian Peninsula, having been there, are harsh. They are oasis communities, and between them lie vast stretches of the most difficult, hot, and unsavory desert environments. No doubt for the community, the early community of Muslims, the evocations of water, of gardens, must have been incredibly, incredibly moving to know that beyond this harsh landscape where water was at a premium and often food was at a premium, where civilization in many ways was far away in Byzantium and in Persia, that something awaited them that was majestic and mighty and awesome. To me, it is this context which is absolutely, absolutely vital in understanding the Muslim paradise. Because as a young person, when I began to look at these verses, they too evoked in me something grand and something beautiful. And the more I looked in our tradition, the more I found details. The Quranic language is incredibly rich. The paradise itself is referred to in so many numerous ways as different types of gardens, and each of those gardens is defined. And of course, because the interaction with the text is a human text, what we find in Islamic poetry, particularly the poetry of in Persia, in the Persian language, in Farsi, is that we find the words for paradise, Rayyan, Bustan, Jannah, appearing again and again, being commented on, being expanded on. And what we get is this evocation of God's incredible generosity. The Quran talks about rivers, and different words are used for rivers. The Hadith literature talks about the rivers of paradise. Different words are used. Some are rivers of honey. Some are rivers of wine. Some are rivers of running and clear water. We are told about the food of paradise, that when one feasts upon it, it'll be like nothing anyone has ever eaten before. And you will never eat it again, because every experience in paradise will exceed the experience that preceded it. There is in this a remarkably sensual characteristic. And that sensual characteristic carries in to what personal relationships exist in paradise. And those relationships are those between life partners, soulmates, husband and wives. One of the great evocative statements about paradise is that one will be with the one he or she loved in paradise, that one will have, when I think about this evocation, I think about my grandparents who were married for 54 years. My grandmother died actually on their anniversary, the anniversary of my grandparents. And I remember how much my grandfather cried that day. We were in Pakistan and she had a long illness. And it ended up being I was the only family member at that moment in the very hot late afternoon under the skies of Punjab, the very hot skies of Punjab. The temperature used to get up to 50 degrees that summer, and I was with my grandmother when she passed away, and I remember my grandfather was in the room next door, and he's disabled and has been since the early 70s, and I remember that when she passed and I was with her, I heard my grandfather starting to cry, and it was funny because he knew she had gone, although he wasn't in the room with her, and I went over and I told him and I sat with him. And in the days that followed, I remember the thing that he turned to the most was this evocative, beautiful notion that he would see his wife, his life partner, in paradise. And that became a kind of, not just a sense of hope for him, but a yearning. Although he lived many years afterwards, there was a yearning. So I remember he made a promise in the days after she died that all of his prayers, he said, I dedicate, you know, half of my prayers, the reward that I will receive, he hoped, to my grandmother. And he would read Quran for her every day, and he would do the litanies of remembrance for her every day. And when I used to go and sit and talk with him, he would speak about Jannah, he would speak about paradise, and he would speak about being together, and he would say, pray for it, my son, pray that we'll be together in that place. It made me understand the importance of this, of how evocative this was, and how, in fact, sensual it was to be with the one you love in every possible way, to have closeness to them in every possible way, to be promised youth after old age. The Prophet Muhammad was once sitting with an elderly woman, and the Prophet was had a wonderful demeanor, would often joke. And so he said, you know, so-and-so said to the woman, you know, the old people, they don't enter paradise. And the woman became a little bit shocked. He said, you know, oh, Prophet of God, how can you say that? He said, of course, old women like you don't enter paradise, because when they enter paradise, they are young and beautiful again. And she smiled and was greatly comforted by that fact. So within this Islamic understanding of paradise is that sensual evocation, but also that the pleasures of the flesh are not divorced from paradise, that they exist within paradise. And this is where maybe the problematic comes when people outside of the Muslim tradition, even some of us inside the Muslim tradition, confront the idea of Muslim paradise as we search for it and we look for it. Because we find in the Muslim paradise a kind of a place of sensual and intimate pleasure, a place where there are companions and beautiful people and beautiful women and men who are almost angelic, small a, angelic creatures that serve us and that are around us and that are with us. And I think for many that raises questions of, what is going on up there? And is it all about, is that what we're working in this life for? Now, I think at one level, some can reduce it to that. But maybe I think to myself, you know what? Everyone needs their motivation. If you got a motivation to be good, you know what? Maybe that's the motivation you need. I used to be a high school teacher. I know that motivation would have worked on some of my students. You be good, man. There's something waiting for you up there. But I don't say that lightly, actually. Because I think the human being is very, very complex. I think there are those of us who can stand back from that and sort of judge that and feel that that's not godly enough, not pure enough. But, you know, human beings are pretty messy and grimy and difficult and broken. We all need the things that will drive us forward to goodness. And I sometimes feel, in reading and rereading again the conceptions and the ideas of Muslim paradise, whether this is not a motivation for some. And what about the martyrs? The martyrs indeed have a high state within Islam. And unfortunately, the concept of martyrdom has become so maligned in our modern age, both by Muslims and those who are not, that it almost needs a topic of its own. And tomorrow night at 7:30 on GTV, there's going to be a fascinating discussion between a Christian, an atheist, and a Muslim on the conception of martyrdom in the modern era, which I hope some of you will have a chance to go to. But if we look at martyrdom as we as Christians and Muslims understand it, in the purity of the word, which is giving oneself for the sake of God, for the sake of justice, for the protection of others, for the preservation of life and property and family and children and goodness and land and all the things that make community, to giving yourself for that, then the evocations of the Prophet's statement are actually evocations that I would say are encouragements, because no martyr is going to fight for those kinds of things and sacrifice themselves for merely a list of giveaways. They're going to do it for a far greater purpose. And that leads me really to the deep nub of what I believe is at the heart of the Muslim conception of paradise. We are told about a great Sufi master, a woman. Some of you may have heard of her. Her name was Rabia. And she lived in the city of Basra. And Basra, as many of you will know, became one of the great early cities of Islamic civilization. And it actually became not only a seat of learning, but a great place of spirituality. And many of the great early mystics of Islam emerged out of Basra. It was a time of political difficulty. It was a time of war within the Muslim community, let alone outside of it. And yet in that time of foment and of political turmoil, there emerged these incredibly powerful characters, and preeminent amongst them, and one of the preeminent amongst them was a woman, Rabia of Basra. And we celebrate Rabia. I grew up listening to stories of Rabia. And Rabia was an incredible woman, beautiful, intelligent, erudite, a scholar in her own right, but someone who chose the way of poverty, as many of the Christian saints did, chose the way of denial, as many of the great men and women of the past did. And she began to actually construct a conception of the hereafter that I think got to the very nub and the core of what Allah, God, asks us to yearn for. When she was asked about the hereafter, she would say, if I do good in this life and I aspire to paradise, close the gates of paradise before me, O God. And if I seek refuge only from the hellfire, then open the doors of hellfire before me. Let me be amongst those who seek only the face of God. Let me be amongst those who seek only the face of God and will reside in His love, abiding for eternity. In that statement, we get to the very heart of what actually we are being called to. The evocations of paradise are important. I see them as almost gateways. They allow us into the world, the majesty, the creative majesty, the evocation, the beauty that we know exists with God, and that God creates in abundance in a way that we cannot even begin to perceive. Those ishara, those indications are vital. But as we come into the paradisal space, as we come into the space of God, what we recognize is that in paradise, the highest state is not the handmaidens, is not the food, and is not the beautiful gardens and the beautiful gifts that God will surely give those of us upon whom He has mercy and favor. But in fact, the greatest gift will be communion with the creative power and the majesty of God Himself. And not only Rabia said this, but it was something that even the early communities, one of the companions of the Prophet Muhammad, one of the ones who was most austere in his practice of religion, used to say that he didn't want but to enter paradise. He said, I wish I could enter paradise with just one foot so I could gaze upon the countenance of God. And that is what the verse of the Quran that I mentioned earlier, and I'll read again. And for the conscientious, there will be gardens with streams, and they will sit in the seat of truth in the presence of an omnipotent sovereign. And it is to that thing, it is to that moment when we, our souls, which came from God, which were created by God, which were nurtured by God, which were placed on earth by God, which were tested by God, which were broken by being human, which became grimy because of our own inadequacies, which sought forgiveness and mercy, that through those difficulties, that through the perseverance, through building communities together, through building families together, to imagine that on that day of reckoning, when we are all gathered together before the majestic presence of God Almighty, that we will have the opportunity to perceive the creative majesty, even for a moment, of the one who created us from nothing, is a magnificent, and for the believer is the most magnificent call. And I believe that even in my own unease about eternity, in my own unease sometimes about sensuality and evocation, I see beyond that to that mighty and majestic moment. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, O people of paradise, and he was saying that the people in paradise, God would call upon them. And he said, God Almighty will, God Most High will say to the people of paradise, O people of paradise, to which they will respond, at your service and no pleasure, all goodness is in your hands. God will ask them, are you content? They will say, oh Lord, how could we not be content when you have given us that which you have given no one else in your creation? Then God will say, would you not like me to give you something better than that? They will respond, oh Lord, what could be better than that? And he will say, I shall cause my good pleasure to descend upon you, and I shall thereafter never be displeased with you. And the scholars who read these texts say that when God says his pleasure will descend, is that he will descend and that we will perceive the presence and the majesty of God Almighty. Of course, paradise, and this is where I'll try to wrap up. Paradise, of course, does not come without difficulty. And of course, there is in conceptions of Muslim paradise clearly a sense of test and reward. We are often told in the Quran about the test, about the perseverance. Won't you be tried as people were tried before you? Won't you be tested as those who were tested before you? So there's a question of test, there's a question of reward, and there is a question of motivation. One of our contemporary scholars, Charles Lagai Eaton, an English Muslim who died a few years ago and who I had the honor of meeting on several occasions and whose works influenced me at a time when I was doubting and denying myself, Charles Lagai Eaton talks about paradise and hell in terms of closeness and distance from God. That when one has closeness to God and is witnessing the divine presence, that one cannot even imagine what that means and the majesty and beauty that contains. But we can imagine distance from God. We can imagine darkness. We can imagine being away from beautiful things, being removed from those we love, from being removed from all sense of mercy and compassion. So in many ways, I think that religious text works at the level of literal, but most powerfully works at the text, it works at the level of metaphor. And the Quran, like the Bible, and this is my firm belief, and this is the firm belief, I believe, of the scholars of the faith, both women and men, is that the sacred texts are there to be interpreted. God didn't give us all the interpretations. God didn't hand us law and theology on a silver platter. It is human endeavor. It is endeavor. It is our hard work of being engaged with text, imagining, challenging, being angered by, being uplifted by. That is what text demands from us. And whether that's paradise or anything else, it demands hard work. And I can't possibly say that I've done the hard work. But we're called to do the hard work. Because for me, this is an ocean, just as the Bible for you is an ocean. Every day when we open it with an open heart or with questions, there's something that it gives us. It provides us personally. It provides for our families and for our communities. What is even more important than paradise is getting there. And I think it's this point that I'd like to finish on. I'd like to finish on with three pieces of text which I would like to share with you. One is from the Quran itself, from the third surah, the family of Imran, the third chapter of the Quran. And it says, "And hasten to forgiveness from your Lord and to a garden broad as the heavens and the earth, prepared for the conscientious, those who spend in good times and in bad, those who refrain and restrain from anger, and those who forgive people. God loves those who do good. And those who remember God and seek forgiveness for their sins if they have done something shameful or wrong themselves. And who forgives sins but God? And those who do not knowingly persist obstinately in what they have done, their reward is forgiveness from their Lord, and gardens with rivers flowing below them, and where they will abide. And how gracious will this reward be for those who work." The Prophet Muhammad was asked once by a very eager companion, tell us about the hour, the coming of the last day. And the Prophet, to paraphrase, responded, "It is not enough to ask about the hour, but what have you prepared for it? What have you sent ahead for it?" And I think to myself that this is the real nub, isn't it? About where the human meets the divine. That this path that we're on, that while we won't get to the Lord by our good works alone, it is his mercy and compassion and generosity and forgiveness and understanding which will facilitate our way. It is something that we are required to do and we are required to be. And therefore, for me, as a believing person and as a Muslim, I think about, well, I may have some questions about the Muslim paradise, but I sure want to get there. I sure want my questions answered. And the best hope I got of getting them answered is getting to paradise. So I can approach God Almighty and I can ask. I had a teacher who passed away a few years ago, a beautiful man who taught me so much. He was an Indian Muslim scholar. And I remember in his little office in a small borough of New York, in this waterlogged office of his, he used to keep behind his desk a statement from the Quran, beautifully framed, and a statement from the Gita, beautifully framed. And as many Muslims would come and ask and say, you know, Maulana, Imam, why do you keep these two statements? He said, we take truth wherever we find it. A beautiful man. And so I asked him once, being young and sort of precocious, I said, Maulana Naseem, I said, when you get to Jannah, when you get to paradise, what will you ask Allah? What will you ask God to give you? And he answered without missing a beat. He said, my son, he said, I'll ask him for the keys to his library. And he said, then I'll ask him to leave me alone. And I used to love that. I used to love that. His sensual pleasure was in the books of human history and in nothing else. Let me read one final passage to you. And this is quoted in a book by the great Muslim mystic and theologian, Imam al-Ghazali, who died 1111. And it is a hadith again. It is a statement of the Prophet Muhammad. But for me as a Muslim, and I share this not as doctrine, but as a personal reflection. For me, this encapsulates the struggle of life and the paradise that awaits us. The messenger of God, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, once while he was seated, laughed so much that his teeth showed. And his companion Omar said, my father and my mother be your ransom, O messenger of God. What is it that made you laugh? The Prophet said, I saw two men from my community fall on their knees before the Lord of power. And one of them said, O Lord, let this one make restitution to me, for he has wronged me. And God, great and glorious, said to the man who had wronged, make restitution to your brother for the wrong you did to him. And that man said, O Lord, I have no good deeds left. There is a conception in Muslim eschatology that on the last day we will be asked to pay our debts to one another. If I have wronged you, I will be called by God to make restitution on the last day. And the way we understand restitution is that if I have good deeds and I have done you wrong, then my good deeds belong to you. And so there is this kind of balancing out on the last day, where if I have done good but I've done wrong, that is balanced out. So the man says, O Lord, I have no good deeds left. So he, God, great and glorious, said to the petitioner, how will you manage with your brother since he has no good deeds left? And the one who was wronged said, O Lord, let him relieve me of some of my burden of sin. Then the messenger of God began to weep. May God's blessings and peace be upon his tearful person, and said, what a mighty day that will be when people will need others to relieve them of their burdens. He, the Prophet Muhammad, went on to say, so God, great and glorious, said to the one who had been wronged, lift your eyes and look into paradise. Lift your eyes and look into paradise. And he did. And he said, O Lord, I see cities of silver and palaces of gold decorated with pearls. For which prophet, for which righteous one, for which martyr is this? The Lord, great and glorious, said, this belongs to whomever pays the price. This belongs to whomever pays the price. And he said, O Lord, who can come up with such a sum? But he, God, said, it is in your power. But how, O Lord? And God answered, by forgiving your brother. And God answered, by forgiving your brother. And the man said, O Lord, I have already forgiven him. So God, great and glorious, said, Take your brother by the hand and lead him into paradise. For me, that is just so powerful that on the last day, and we are reminded in Christian and Muslim traditions of the magnitude of the last day, that in the presence of God where this conversation is taking place, it is this act of forgiveness. It is this act of forgiveness when we ourselves will be penitent and poor before God Almighty, that this is the thing that will take us into paradise. And then the prophet concluded saying, Fear God and make peace amongst yourselves, for God, may he be blessed and exalted, will make peace amongst those who believe on the day of resurrection. This is the mighty price. Whatever paradise holds for us, this is the mighty price we must pay, and we must begin to pay it now. Forgiveness, compassion, mercy, of course, begins now. If we don't have the capacity for those things now, how will we have it on the last day? And how will we even hope to see God's reward? I think to myself that this is the real challenge of the human being in our temporal flesh form, in this weak, grimy state that we are in, that this is the challenge that faces us, to be forgiving and compassionate and generous and expansive. And for that, for achieving that real challenge, for building that reality in our souls, I have no doubt, I have absolutely no doubt, and God is my witness, that there is a real reward that awaits each and every one of us in this life and the life to come. As we say, and God knows best about all things. Thank you very much. We have about 11 minutes, and I know some of you will have to go, and that's okay. But I'm happy to take any questions, any concerns, queries, challenges. It's all good. And we do have a roving mic. I don't know how well we'll do, so you may have to just shout. I see a hand over there. If there's a few, I see a hand over there. Do I see any other one? I see a hand over there. So let's take those three. Four. I see four.
If the people at the back could try and move slightly down, just around the side, okay, I'll come
so
around that way.
So let's take these five. Yeah. That gentleman there, yeah. That lady there,
great.
That gentleman there, and that lady there. And then we can do another round. Okay. Go ahead, sir. So one conception of martyrdom. Let me just go in a line. Go ahead. Absolutely. Martyrdom. The question of the virgins. Go ahead, sir. And it's in the Islamic conception, it's the permission. On that day, the permission, of course, is God's permission, as it is here. But in that realm, when there is destitution, human destitution, that God would allow us to do that is out of His mercy and His great compassion. Go ahead, sir. I'm happy to answer those two. I'll answer them together. And very good lady back there. answering the question of martyrdom first. In the majority Muslim conception, and there are some very small minority voices who have been challenged and actually who have been refuted, the whole notion of suicide bombing and the killing of civilians or the killing of yourself is absolutely abhorrent and illegal in Islam. In fact, one of the scholars, contemporary Muslim scholars, who draws on the tradition, Dr. Tim Winter, will be here this afternoon at 2 o'clock in the Big Top. He has written a rejection of that position, Sheikh Afifi Al-Akiti at the University of Oxford. And I'm referring to Western Muslims in the first instance, but also those in the East who have rejected this idea. That, in fact, what we understand, and I, having worked in areas of counterterrorism through my work, have sought to understand what motivates and inspires those who commit these dastardly acts. And for the most part, our understanding is that it is political. And in fact, what happens is that organizations and the ideology that underpins organizations or movements or trends like Al-Qaeda are in fact those that try to actually pry Muslims away from the moral and ethical framework that they know to be true. We live in a time of extreme politics, and extreme politics creates extreme reactions. Part of our work within the Muslim discourse has been to reject both the extreme politics and the extreme illegitimate, unethical responses to those politics. That is the challenge of now. But that is what our greatest scholars, both women and men, and our greatest movements have been trying to do. And this is before 9/11. 9/11 was only, in a way, the shocking fruit of something that had been going on for 30, 40, some would say 150 years, whereby the text is being made brittle and literal and dead. And what you find with any kind of literalism is that you find aberration. And the beauty of religion and interpretation, discourse and scholarship is that, of course, there's core to religion, practice and belief, but there's also flexibility and understanding due to context. And that's something that, of course, every religious tradition understands, and those who try to undermine that strongly. In fact, in this country, and I mean, it's particularly after 9/11 and 7/7, the voices have been strong. But I can talk about my own experience at the university campus in the mid-90s when suicide attacks began in Palestine. I stood with other Muslims to reject those kinds of actions at the time when politics was high and people were making excuses for it. But what I've learned from my teachers is that the high road is the road that we take, whether you are in distress or whether you are in ease. That's what a religious man and woman are called to, is the highest road. The idea of martyrdom is that there's, of course, rules of warfare and rules of engagement. It's often said that the tradition, for example, tells us that if someone were to run into a burning building to save somebody's life and died in the process, they would be a martyr. Those who give their lives for the sake of others, for saving life, for ameliorating people's condition, are martyrs. Those who died serving in relief work, I believe they are martyrs. They are martyrs before God, and they should be treated as such, as much as those people who die in war. I mean, that is the understanding. Of course, martyrdom within a martial sense, of course, exists in Islam as exists in other traditions. But martial law, and I use that now in a legal term, the laws that govern rules of engagement and warfare are vast. Just as in the Christian tradition, you have just war, concept of just war. That has been challenged. Of course, that the theological question, those also exist within Islam and those ethical frameworks. I think it's very important for us to reject what is clearly rejected: suicide bombing, this kind of illegitimate, nasty warfare brought on by the most extreme kind of politics and oppression must be rejected. And in fact, I think part of what the panel will look at tomorrow is how do we really define martyrdom in the time that we live in. Recently, we in the Muslim community felt the loss of someone by the name of Khalil Dale, a Red Cross worker, someone from the United Kingdom who was a convert to Islam, who was killed, we understand, by members of the Pakistani Taliban. He was a Muslim, a believing Muslim. He had worked in relief work all his life in Somalia and in Ethiopia and some of the most difficult places in the world. He was killed. Do we consider him a martyr? I certainly do. Someone who is in service to others. So the question of martyrdom is a vast question. And you will find definitely within Islam, the rules of warfare are vast. But they're also contextual. When there were Islamic empires and polities, laws and application of those laws is different. In the circumstances we live in are different. That's why law is flexible, and law continues needing to be looked at. And this notion that somehow legal reasoning or legal understandings have been exhausted, frankly, doesn't wash with me. And in terms of the Muslim Christian dynamic, I agree with you. I think in the United Kingdom we're very blessed. I think we have found in church leaders like Dr. Rowan Williams and people, men and women across the country, at a local parish level or a national level, a great appetite. One of the great things that have happened in the last 10 years is something called the Common Word. The Common Word was a letter that was issued in the aftermath of the Danish cartoon controversy by major Muslim religious scholars, both women and men, to Christian congregations and denominations across the world. And that has begun a dialogue now, which has gone right up to the Vatican. Most recently, one of my teachers, Habib Ali al-Jifri, was actively involved with the late Pope Shenouda in Egypt in trying to rectify issues between Coptic and Muslim Egyptians. Some extremists within Egypt have made the most horrendous kind of remarks about the position of Copts in Egyptian society, when we know Coptic Christians predated Islam's coming and have lived together with Muslims at times in great peace, at times with great tension. And I would say now is a time perhaps of tension. So we see scholars engaging in that. That needs to happen more often. But as we understand, with our Jewish friends and brothers and sisters in humanity, we share a lot when it comes to law and it comes to the interpretation of law and text. But I often feel that with our Christian brothers and sisters in humanity, we share a lot of spirit. And I think our belief in the personality of Jesus, upon whom be peace, is actually a powerful meeting ground for us and of his family and of his disciples. And I think for Muslims, when I come to Greenbelt, I understand the theological context that you're coming from, but I'm not offended by it. For me, it's a way for me to experience your understanding of the Prophet, who is central to your tradition and who is essential to your understanding of God. And from that, filtering through my theological understanding, I can take so much, and I do take so much. And I think that sitting down is really, really important. And I know in our community we have a lot of work to do in terms of breaking down barriers, encouraging Muslims to visit churches, and then, of course, vice versa. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, it's lifelong work, but there's good people out there doing that work. I'll take maybe 3-4 more points, and then we can even end there, and then we can talk. But I'd like to – it's good to kind of hear. So I hear one person there. Did I miss a question? Oh, I'm so sorry. Ixnay that. Back to the virgins. I just want to read you. I'd like to read you something from a Muslim female scholar who addressed this question, and I had it with me because I think she addresses it beautifully. And then I'll make a comment about it. So Ustada Zainab Ansari, who is an American-born scholar who trained in seminaries in the Muslim world, and now is an active teacher both online and in person. She says, in answering this question, the Quran gives women spiritual parity with men in terms of their status before God and their religious obligations and the recompense of their deeds. The pleasures of paradise, including pure and righteous companions, are not exclusively for men. God says in the second surah of the Quran, Al-Baqarah, in verse 25, "But give glad tidings to those who believe and work righteousness, that their portion is gardens beneath which rivers flow. Every time they are fed with fruits therefrom, they say, why? This is what we were fed with. Why? This is what we were fed with before, for they are given things in similitude, and they have therein companions pure and holy, and they abide therein for eternity." She continues, "These companions pure and holy in Arabic are called Azwaj Mutahhara, and Azwaj is the plural of Zoj, which means mate, spouse, or companion. The promise in this verse is directed at the believers at large, both male and female, that they will have righteous spouses waiting for them in paradise. Some scholars have said that if a believer so desires, she or she will be reunited from their spouse from the earthly life." So there is this sense within the Arabic language itself that the language is vast enough to include both men and women. Now, the question is often asked quite rightfully, why is often these statements of the Prophet in particular aimed at men? Well, often it was men who were going to war. And so you can understand the context in which certain sayings of the Prophet would have been given. Now, the added question, which is an important question you ask, is that is the idea of maidens in paradise, which may or not be a sexual connotation. Let's make that clear. There is some possibility for that, as there is sex in paradise. But is it a primarily sexual connotation, or is it something about being served? This is a point of contention, and I think of legitimate debate. But in terms of the language itself, the language, the Arabic language in particular, allows something a bit more vast than that. Now, there is, of course, in our times, a question of interpretation. And it would be dishonest to say that these interpretations, very male-centric interpretations, have not been challenged. They are being challenged, and they are being questioned. And that's the nature of where theology is at. I think there is a sense, not unfounded, that classical theology often is male-centric. I don't think that is unusual for any religious tradition. It may not be acceptable for any religious tradition. And therefore, there is, I think, going on within contemporary Islam, both in the East and in the West, a very strong engagement with texts now that is coming from women and women scholars. Now, women's scholarship within the Islamic tradition is very strong. But in fact, we see a decline in women scholars at a certain point in Islamic history. During the first centuries of Islam, you see in the biographies of the scholars of Islam, many, many women scholars. In fact, some of the great theologians counted amongst their teachers thousands of female scholars. That, unfortunately, has declined, and I think that's a crisis right now within the Muslim spiritual religious community. I think it's a crisis. I think it is a problem. And I think it is beginning to be rectified, but I think it's going to take generations to try and rectify that. So we can't write them out of the equation. They're there in text. Can we understand them and contextualize them? I certainly think we can. And can I, as a Muslim, make peace with it? Yes. Yes. Go ahead. You know, in a way, it's the way we would look at angels, right? And I know angels are such a vast theological question in many faith traditions. But, you know, the Muslim belief in angels is that angels are creations of God who serve at the pleasure of God, that they themselves don't have agency. And so this idea that within paradise there will be certain elements which then serve at the will of God and don't have agency of their own is actually not a difficult one to countenance within the understanding of what Muslim paradise is, and particularly of, say, angelic forms within paradise. And I've seen scholars often equate the servants in paradise as kind of angelic beings, although that also can be open to interpretation. I know many of you have to go.
We can probably have one more question.
Yeah,
that's it.
And I had accepted the gentleman there, although maybe we can squeak in one there as well. If you keep it short, please, he keeps it short, it'll be one. I'll answer that one first. You're absolutely right. And in fact, there's a whole literature around numbers, 7, 100, 70, 72. I mean, there is a sense that a lot of these numbers exist in metaphor, that they indicate many. They indicate a great number. They indicate a multitude upon multitude. Often in Islam, we jokingly sometimes call it the calculus of reward and punishment. So if you do X act, you get, a trick happens. You do X act, you times it by 10, square it by 2, and then you add it to the... Oh, okay, yes, now we have a certain reward quotient. Now I often joke with my more literal friends about this. Absolutely. So I think that in those numbers, like 72 or 70, there is a metaphorical value, which can be explored and has been explored, certainly. In terms of the relationship between Islam and Judaism, there is a Tel Aviv-Tehran politics right now, which is dangerous, which I think we as citizens of this country should be concerned about, as citizens of the world should be concerned about. The war bangers and the war beaters in those two places are placing really placing at risk all of us, especially when we put into nuclear frame, when we put that in a nuclear frame. In terms of Islam and Judaism, we have the same relationship as we do with Christianity. We believe, and the Quran tells us, that Christians and Jews are people of the book. We honor them because they have a testament that came before the Quran. Our book honors their prophets. We honor their prophets, and we sit as brothers and sisters in humanity. And the Quran calls us to what is the common word between us. Common word between us that is the thing that we can unite on. I think the Palestinian question is a serious question. The Palestinian question is a great tragedy. The self-determination for the Palestinian people and the great tragedy that has been wrought upon those people is something that stands on the conscience of the world. And it is unfortunate that relations between Jews and Muslims in terms of faith communities have been colored by the politics of the Holy Land. I think there is a way past it. I think there is a way for us that if we were to unite on values of religion and faith, that we could find a way forward. I think it is absolutely vital, as people like Oliver McTiernan and others have suggested, that rabbis, imams, priests, ministers, lay people, but religious people, faithful people, godly people, be engaged in the processes of peacemaking. And I think that the most successful processes of peacemaking are those that are done by people of faith, because we can look beyond a territory and boundary and see what we can see, the God that we all worship and the God that the place Jerusalem represents. Because Jerusalem is not, of course, only the place where the temple was built and not only the place where Christ was crucified and then in the Christian belief resurrected, but is the place that Muslims believe that the Prophet Muhammad went to on his journey through the night, and from there he ascended to heaven to have communion with God. We believe that he met all the prophets, including Jesus and Moses, on that fateful night, which we call the Isra and the Miraj. For us, that place is holy, and the Temple Mount is holy, the Temple of the Jews is holy, the place of the Christians is holy. That's our belief as Muslims. And there's nothing, I would say, in our history. There are many things that can be criticized about Islamic history, but I think one of the things that we have most, can be most proud of, is the protection of those holy sites in times of war. What is the solution? I guess it's a good mind, but I do believe that there is common ground. In fact, here again in this country, you know, I'm a British citizen now and have been for many years and lived here, like I said, on and off for 15, but full time for 9. I've had the most amazing encounters with the Jewish community, and we continue to find ways of working together, find ways of creating art together, having dialogue together. At the same time, we're always honest with each other. We always say that we are not going to put aside the question of the Holy Land, because it would be dishonest to you and dishonest to us to do so. And we should not do it, but we should find a way to talk about it. And I think that's where we're at right now. And I think we need to reject the warmongers, whether they're in Tehran or Tel Aviv or in Washington or in London or anywhere else. The right-wing lobbies and those who want to see us to go into war and nuclear Armageddon and who want to push this thing to the brink, we need to reject them, and we need to get on our government's case to reject them, and we need to support the amazing people. And I go into G-Source and I see Christians with the full strength of their faith going into those places, putting their lives on the line. We should honor them as we honor Jews and Muslims who do the same. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.